direct. From Guano Productions headquarters in the Los Angeles Underground, it's time for your new favorite podcast, The Superiority Complex. It's like honey in your ear holes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Superiority Complex, your new favorite podcast. Although I shouldn't say that anymore. It's probably your favorite by now. It's probably been your favorite for a long time. And if it hasn't been, we need to have a chat. My guest today is Brian Rodriguez. Now, Brian, hello, Brian. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mario. Thanks for having me.
Now, here's the thing. Brian and I do not – we have very little – we came in contact with each other very recently. I sound like it's a patient zero situation. We came in contact with one another. No, but we met very recently, and Brian – I just happened to mention in passing, like I do to everybody – that I have a podcast. And Brian, usually most people go, oh, yeah, that's cool. And then the next thing is, what's a podcast? That's usually the next question. And then when I tell them what it is and or what we talk about, they have the, oh, okay. And then they just go on and never listen, which is fine. I'm used to that. But Brian actually expressed an interest in coming on. He asked some questions and he said, hey, you know, if you I'm going to be in town for a couple of weeks and if you want to have a guest on, let's do it. And I said, sure, let's, you know, I'm always game when someone wants to come in and talk. I'm always fascinated by like what the outcome could be. So we have something in common in that we are both, well, you have family that lives here in Uptown. We record in Uptown Whittier, and you have family that lives here.
That's right.
But you were actually raised in the faraway land of Texas.
That's right.
Is that right?
In San Antonio, Texas.
San Antonio.
Right.
So how did your family come to, or how did you end up in San Antonio and the rest of the family end up here in Whittier?
Well, great question, actually. So I'm the first generation in my family that hasn't grown up in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad grew up in literally South Central Los Angeles,
yeah.
Like Compton. He's Mexican-American. My mother is German-American, and she grew up here in Uptown. With her family. She's one of six children. They met up later in my dad's life, got married. He was a LA County Sheriff's commander.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the deputies and the whatnot, and the captains, and then there's three commanders underneath the sheriff. So they met up. She was a secretary here at some local city council, whatever. And they met up. They started dating. They got married, and my dad applied for the chief of police job in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he applied for that job just to see how the process would go. Lo and behold, longer story short, he got the job.
Wow.
And so my mom never thought of leaving Southern California. She is a Southern California girl all the way. She loves her 70-degree weather.
Yeah, right now it's 70
yeah,
degrees outside.
Yeah, well, yeah, normally it would be a lot cooler than
Brian
this, right?
Brian brought a little bit of that Texas weather with him.
That's right.
A lot of that Texas weather
oh,
with him.
Oh, my gosh. But you know, the joke that he would always tell if he was telling the story is that he said, hey, Donna, you want to move to Texas? And she said, heck no, I don't want to move to Texas. Are you kidding me? Why on earth would I want to do that? And then things kept going and going, and he got the job, and then they made the decision to move to Texas. And so that's why I was born and raised in Texas.
You know, it's funny because you have a little bit of the Texas accent, but you
yeah.
don't have a lot of it.
Right.
I think it's probably because your parents are
exactly.
from
exactly yeah.
your parents are from your California. You could
yeah.
you could pass for not. I would have never known him. And then, but it, now that I know you're from Texas, and I kind of hear
yeah, there's a little bit of it.
There's a little bit of it, but you have the kind of the California. You
yeah.
kind of have that little bit of. That's really cool though, because I'll bet your mom just spun you stories of In-N-Out hamburgers
oh
and things
gosh.
Like that.
And she visits out here all the time, and so she'll constantly be bringing me T-shirts from In-N-Out and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. Whittier is weird in that way, in that you know, it's in a weird part of the geography of Southern California where it's close enough. It's close to L.A., but people don't really, when they think of L.A., they don't really think of the suburb out here
mm-hmm.
because it's. It's, I guess it's considered part of what they call the San Gabriel Valley,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is like from Pasadena on, you know, south, but it's really not, you know, it doesn't have, it's not like any of those other cities. It's kind of like off by itself.
Yeah.
We're separated by like the other side of the 60 freeway kind of cuts us off from the rest of the San Gabriel
right.
Valley.
Right.
And, so it's really weird geographically, and it's like halfway, if you're not familiar with Southern California, where we are is where we're, I always tell people we're halfway between, you know, a lot downtown Los Angeles and Disneyland, like that's the actual,
mm-hmm.
and it's, but it's really kind of a, it still holds like a small town.
It does.
It really feels, and a lot of the families, I'll bet you, we don't have time to do it today, but I'll bet you if I sat down with your mom and I talked to her, there's going to be, our family somehow know each other because my family was pretty well known in the city for, we were like the last farmers in the area. Right. So like people knew the people, you know, when I describe to people where my grandfather had his house, they're like, oh yeah, I remember that place. You know, it's one of those things. So, it's just fascinating that people, and so I just recently moved away from Whittier, and it was weird because I started thinking about how much of my extended family still lives here, because I have a lot of cousins, and they almost all of them still live, you know, within like a 5 mile radius of where we are now.
Right.
So for your mom, that had to be like a
huge change. And I mean, I'm spending time with my grandma and staying at her house, and while I'm out here, and one of her other daughters lives three houses down.
Yeah.
And then another one of her daughters lives three or four blocks away.
That's Whittier, man, for sure.
Exactly.
That's
exactly how you do it. Yeah. And it's, and my mom literally picked up and moved halfway around the country.
And so your mom's still in Texas.
Mm-hmm. My mom and my dad are still in Texas.
Yeah. So what was it like? I mean, obviously you have, it's hard to compare to, you know, Southern California, but would you come out here and visit a lot as a kid?
We did. Yeah. So I really kind of grew up with two hometowns, I would say. I would say Southern California and then obviously Texas, because we spent a lot of time out here in the summer. And my family has houses up in Lake Arrowhead, too, so I spent a lot of time up there.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
So I got a kind of a feel for Southern California a lot growing up, whether it be down here, down the hill, as we would say, or up in the mountains.
Yeah, down the hill. That's funny. That's so funny. I don't understand why it is so hot. Well, we're going to go back to that. Do you feel like you're back in Texas right now?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty hot. There's not as much humidity out here. But,
oh, thank God.
It's definitely pretty hot. I know 100 is not the normal.
Well, you know, people forget it. I hate to talk about the weather. I get mad when people on Facebook talk about the weather. I'm like, we have windows. But it's so unusually hot right now that I think people are just but I think people are always shocked at how hot that California does get this hot. And I always tell people September's the hottest month, man. People forget. Mm-hmm. They think, summer's over. We're done. Mm-hmm. No, we're not. We're getting right at the end. It just makes you feel. I'm just glad because I don't have to hear about pumpkin spice lattes and see UGG boots for a little while. So in San Antonio, like, what's the? I'm always. You know what comes up a lot, and you being Mexican American, that comes up a lot on the show. Just because I realize as I get older, it really kind of. I wouldn't say it affects everything, but I'm more aware of it now. Mm-hmm. Whereas I didn't think about it much
when
you're younger. So, I mean, what's it like growing up in Texas? I mean, San Antonio, I got to assume there's a huge Latino population down.
Yeah, very huge.
Yeah.
Actually, I believe a couple of years ago, the Latino population overtook the majority of the population of San Antonio.
Were people freaking out?
There's some people who were freaking out, I imagine.
But the nice thing is you're half, so you're like a spy.
Yeah.
So like, you can like infiltrate. Yeah. You can like infiltrate.
Yeah.
Like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
So where my daughter's going to be. My daughter does not look. Until summertime when she starts to swim, you can't tell. And then all of a sudden you're like, hey, that kid's messed up.
I'm sure that's exactly how everybody says it.
Yeah.
Wait a second.
You've been like a Cylon on Battlestar Galactica. Wait a minute. The whole time. did you like the big thing with Texas, obviously, like Texas and California kind of have like this. Mm-hmm. There's like a rivalry, man. There's like, you know, we have better football. No, we have better football. You know, like the food, the Mexican food. Mm-hmm. Is it like being so close to. And I think L.A. being so close to Mexico, I think we still get a lot of that cultural influence a lot. Is that the same way in Texas, San Antonio?
Definitely. I'd say there's a huge cultural influence in just – especially as you go down in the generations, you know, these people immigrated one generation ago and their kids, you know, speak English and totally normalize and, you know, just have melted into that melting pot. But then – one or two generations back, people's families still live in Mexico.
Yeah.
And so there's obviously a connection there. There is a heavy influence there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so what's, I've never been to Riverwalk. I see it on the, I see it on TV. What's it like? Is it cool?
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, it's a nice place to visit. They have a lot of conventions and stuff there. A lot of big companies or whatever go and have their retreats there. It's a nice place.
So if you're in San Antonio, sports wise, who are the teams everybody's rooting for? Because you're kind of like you can go either way.
We really only have one professional team.
The Spurs.
Yeah, which is huge and really kind of everything.
Yeah, you know what? And here's the thing about the Spurs. As a Lakers fan. I hate the Spurs, but I also grudgingly admire the Spurs because, and I don't know if you're a basketball fan.
I am a huge basketball
fan. Okay, good. We can, awesome. Let's talk about basketball. The thing I hate about the Spurs is the thing I hate about the Patriots in that they are technically
always good.
They're always good, but here's why. They are fundamentally sound, which means they're not always exciting to watch.
Right.
But they get in there and they grind out games and they make it. So I hate it because, you know, as a Lakers fan, I want to see flash, man. I want to see some dunk. You know, you don't see that. You know, the Spurs are going to pass the ball around. They're going to do some layups. You know what I mean? It's not always going to be like this awesome dunk to finish it off, but they're going to score on you. Mm-hmm. And they always have like depth at with their bench. They always got a deep bench. Some guy that'll come off some Euro that'll come off the bench and just bury that dagger in your heart when you're just trying to like, damn you, Ginobili. but then, of course, you know, going back, you know, have the tradition of like, you know, David Robinson, you know, back in those days,
the admiral.
But I always grudgingly admire. Like there are teams that I hate as a Lakers fan. Like I used to hate the Jazz, you know, back in the day, the Celtics, of course. You know, the Supersonics would always come down and give us some trouble, you know, your West Coast rivals and stuff. But those Spurs were always just so good and never, you know, and they were so quiet about it. They had like that quiet. So I grudgingly respect, you know, those Spurs, man. Did you go to a lot of Spurs games growing up?
Growing up, I did, absolutely. When, you know, I lived in San Antonio for the first 18 years of my life, basically. So definitely growing up and went to church, the same church David Robinson went to church, and
they were
really connected in the community in a lot of different ways.
That's cool. He was always such a good role model.
Yeah, incredible.
Such a good role model.
Really, just lives out his faith, and pretty difficult place to do it in the NBA.
Yeah, in the NBA. No, and he was always he always stuck to his guns and just always you know, he was one of those guys. He was on the other team, but you respected him.
Oh yeah,
and you were just just like, damn you, David Robinson.
Well, y'all done pretty good with Kobe out here, but
yeah, Kobe. The thing of Kobe is a lot of the off, you know, and it depends on where you fall with Kobe, but he's a hard worker. Whatever antics, you know, off.
That's what he's all about.
He's a hard worker, and he's the first to show up and kind of have that dedication. I don't see a lot of that in the NBA now. I see, you know, it's, you know, obviously we've come a long way from the times from guys like Bill Russell and you know, and things like that. But I feel like a lot of times, and I think it's in all sports. I just think there's a general lack of, I think there's so much money from other sources, like, you know, shoe contracts and things like that, that I don't think that guys necessarily feel like they have to really put it out on the field. Right. You know what I mean? That's why I respect a guy like Clayton Kershaw, who from the Dodgers, the pitcher for the Dodgers, who works hard. And then in the off season, he and his wife have, like, they do missionary. Well, they don't do missionary work, but they open a school in Africa. And they spent a lot of the off season there, you know, fundraising
awesome.
Yeah. And then, you know, again, you know, in an area that's not, it's not always easy to kind of share your faith. They do it via their actions where, you know, a lot of these guys in the off season are out, you know, partying somewhere, but him and his wife, they go to Africa and they, you know, they help out with the school and, you know, it's really great to see somebody at that level.
Yes.
But I noticed there's that correlation. There's that, you know, that dedication, that hard work, you know, it's that kind of quiet, you know, so, but I really like that. But yeah, man, Robinson used to give me fits. And Duncan too, man.
Duncan's on number 5 now, going for number 6.
He's reaching Robert Horry territory, man. Robert Horry, man.
Played for the Lakers.
Robert Horry played for everybody.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but he had Spurs. He had that beautiful shot that I missed in the playoffs, that Robert Horry. because my wife's cousin got married and didn't have a TV at her wedding. I missed the Robert Ory buzzer beater. I'll never forget that. I don't know if she listens, but she doesn't. Well, I know my wife listens, but I don't know if her cousin listens. So, what else did you do when you were growing up in San Antonio? Were you involved in any kind of sports? What did you like to do when you were growing up?
Absolutely. So I played sports. Really, sports were my first love. Mm-hmm. Basketball in particular. I can remember watching every single Spurs game every season when I was a kid. And I played basketball pretty religiously. Played soccer and football and baseball. And as I got into middle school and high school, kind of narrowed it down to just soccer, football, and basketball. But I was very, very much into sports and athletics. And that kind of set me up for what I ended up doing later. I had no idea at the time.
Yeah.
But I was primarily an athlete growing up.
That was, yeah, it's awesome because I have the opposite where I loved to play and had no coordination or skill whatsoever. But I just like to get out there and play. I mean, I grew up in a very competitive family. My cousin was a great. He had a legendary little league career. if he had stuck with it, he probably could have played collegiately, maybe gone pro. He was a great pitcher, but he just, it was one of those things where I think he just got tired of it because he had a lot of everybody was like, oh, I think it wasn't fun for him anymore, and he just ended up doing other things, and he's been very successful in his life and one of the most generous people I know. But I would play against him, and he just had all the natural talent in the world, and he could play, had a great arm, and then we'd go play basketball, and he would be out. I remember as a kid, we'd be at his house and we'd all be playing, we were getting into our teen years and, we'd be inside playing, music or whatever, playing games or whatever. And he'd be out shooting free throws at like midnight. Just like, I gotta get better. He's like that competitive that spirit. And I think that if I had worked harder, I don't think I would have been good at it, but I could have been better at it than I was.
Right.
But I used to love to play, and even though I was terrible at it, so I always have a respect for people that are good athletically. And did you have a favorite? Was basketball was the passion?
Basketball was my favorite, especially as a younger kid. But then in high school, in Texas in particular, everything just becomes about football.
Friday Night Lights, man.
And so I kind of went that way myself, which I really enjoyed and really loved. So,
what did you play?
I played quarterback.
What?
Yeah, I was a quarterback. I started from my sophomore year. I lettered all 4 years, but then I started my sophomore year to my senior year at quarterback for our team. And that was just an incredible experience. Learned so much and had a ton of fun.
That's awesome.
It. Yeah, I loved it.
What was your I don't want to talk about your greatest triumph. I want to talk about the play that haunts you. Do you have a play that haunts you to this day?
Oh my gosh, the play that haunts me. I can remember that. Our senior year, we had a really good year, a winning season. We were in this really competitive league, in a preparatory league. And we had this great year, and we had been beating all these teams that everybody didn't think we were going to beat and everything. But then for some reason, we had scheduled the best team in the league, a team called Cistercian, a private school, Catholic school from Dallas, actually. Scheduled them for homecoming of all the games. And so
he's, for those of you who can't see, Brian is breaking out in a cold sweat right now.
So we scheduled the best team in our league for homecoming. And, I mean, we just prepare incredibly that week and just had this great game plan. We had some amazing coaches. We had a guy who was a four-year starter at Pitt in college D1 team over on the East Coast, a guy who made the Cowboys practice squad. I mean, we had a bunch of guys who were just awesome coaches. So we had these awesome coaches, this awesome prep, and we played this team perfectly. I think the score was tied maybe in the 30s going into the fourth quarter or something like that. Played them perfectly. And then a guy that I later got to know, his name's Austin Rivers, actually. This skinny little guy.
Of course he's from Texas. Yeah. Austin Rivers. Right. Are you kidding me?
I actually ran into Austin, got to meet him years ago. But anyways, at the time I didn't know him. And this skinny little guy caught this pass right over one of our linebackers and ran it in for like 60 yards and won the game. Yeah, and that actually made the difference between us. Only like a couple teams made the playoffs. And so that game made the difference between us going to the playoffs or not. I met this guy years later. Is the only catch he had for a touchdown that whole year.
Wow.
And it was like the highlight of his life. And he's this great guy. I met him at a Christian camp, actually. We were both working there. And he's this great guy. And he's like, yeah, I only had one touchdown catch my whole life. Is at this school in San Antonio. And I go, that was my school, and that was my homecoming
game. Oh, man, that's so funny.
Yeah.
And you're at a Christian camp, so you can't punch him in the face. Right, right. Well, you could. You turn the other cheek.
there you go.
He's gonna...
yeah.
But
so that haunts me.
But you know what, though? At least, look, if you're going to give up a catch like that, if you're mm-hmm. going to – it's the guy has a cool name. He's like an astronaut name,
yeah,
man. Come on.
He does have a cool name. He's a nice guy.
I just wanted to let you know, for all Latinos everywhere, you let us down. Like, I just want you to know. Okay? Just so you know, man. Just so, yeah. Just so there's no – no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. See, you know, my brothers were my brothers played high school athletic – or my brothers played were athletes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just – I didn't get the gene, man. I didn't get it. I didn't get it, and it was frustrating when I was growing up. But I think my love of sports, I've talked about it before, my love of sports helped me hide the fact that I had all these geeky other things where I was reading comic books and stuff. Because I could talk basketball or talk, you know, baseball or whatever. And I wasn't a huge pro football fan growing up. My dad was a huge UCLA fan, so he would get season tickets. And I remember the first game I ever went to that he took us to, I remember coming out of the one of the, you know, the tunnels at the Rose Bowl. And just seeing the grass and just, I remember, I mean, to this day, like it just, it's burned in my
memory.
And the first game we it was BYU versus UCLA and Steve Young beat the Bruins.
Oh my gosh.
The future 49ers quarterback beat the Bruins, man. But that was my first, taste of like football at that level. And man, I remember that game like it was. I mean, I still remember everything. I think I was about 10 or 11. And my dad would, you know, I'd been to Dodgers games, and I think my dad really waited until I could appreciate going to being able to sit and like watch the entire game and not want to mess around and sit there. And I was, it was riveting, man. It was just the whole pageantry of it. I just really, really, you know, there's something in college football that's missing from pro football. I like pro football now.
I agree.
But there's just something, that passion that just, that isn't there at like the pro level.
There's more of a connection to the team.
I think it is, and I think a lot of it is. I think it's a lot of guys like you that had that experience where they just came out of 4 years playing at high school, and maybe the realization that hey, this could be my last 4 years doing this.
Yeah.
And they play it like that level. Yeah. And they play for a different reason than they play for. I mean, obviously those guys that go on to the NFL are, you know, they just have a different talent set altogether. So
yes, definitely.
So some of those guys, like, you know, you see it every week on ESPN College. There's an Austin Rivers every week. There's a guy making a catch. You know, there's some sophomore you never heard of, and he's busting a big play like that. And it might be the only time you ever hear about him. But for that week, man, he's all over the top 10.
Yeah, his 5 seconds of fame there.
That's
yeah.
awesome. So what do you, I mean, as far as like pro football, who's your team?
Well, I grew up on the Cowboys.
So you're a Cowboys fan.
I am a Cowboys
fan. I don't know if you know this.
I think I know where you're going.
I don't know if you know this, but America's team. I did not know this.
Yeah, I didn't.
I did not receive the memo.
I'm a huge proponent of
that. I did not receive the memo that I had voted.
Yeah, you missed
that
election.
You know, I think with the Patriot Act stuff, that got stuffed in there like – Dallas Cowboys, now America's team. It was like, all right, everybody.
You never know what.
Here's your Romo jersey. I'm like, what? When did I just got this in the mail? This isn't even, I don't even, what? So you're a Cowboys fan?
I'm a huge Cowboys fan.
My one of our listeners, Jonathan Orozco, you can follow him what is he Orozco Leche? I forgot what he is on Twitter, but he's a huge Cowboys fan, the biggest Cowboys fan, man. So
yeah, I've been following them because when I was so young, right around in the mid-90s, when they were winning back-to-back championships with Aikman and Irving and Deion, Showtime and everything, I fell in love with them. They kind of staked their claim out in Texas too. They have their training camp. They switch between California and San Antonio.
Yeah.
So they kind of claimed their territory, especially after the Texans came on the scene. And so
Houston doesn't get the love, man,
right,
in
right.
Texas.
And so I grew up with the Cowboys, and, you know, I have been suffering for the last who knows however many years, 17, 20 years now.
Hey, you know what, though? I mean,
we've done well in the playoffs.
As a representative of Los Angeles, on behalf of the UCLA Bruins, you're welcome for Troy Aikman. But, no, it's hard. You know, it's hard when you love a team. And I'm a Dodgers fan, so it's been – we're coming up on 30 years, man. It's 88 yeah. was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it's hard to just kind of, you know, I always, it's just like, you can't, it's like the girl who, she knows her boyfriend's cheating on her all the time and she just can't say, no, I love you, babe. Like we're going to, and he just gives her the speech like, oh, you know, you're the only one for me. And then, okay. And then he takes off on a business trip and then you know what happens. That's the way it is being a fan of a team that just lets you down all the time.
Gosh.
It's the worst, man. What do you think? Where do you think you, what, let me pick your football brain. What do you think? What are the changes you think the Cowboys need to make to be a successful? I mean, aside from like Jerry Jones just staying out of it, right?
Well, yeah. There's...
What's the in Texas? What do you guys think about? I mean, is he popular?
Most people, he's very unpopular.
I would imagine so.
He's very unpopular, especially people from an older generation because they remember, which I wasn't really conscious yet. They remember how he came in and what he did with Tom Landry.
Yeah, Landry, yeah.
All of that. And so there's a lot of bitterness and grudgement, you know, just there with that situation. They hold on to that, really. Just,
yeah.
You know, these 40, 50-year-old men that just know. From that, I've stopped being a Cowboys fan. They disown the Cowboys.
Yeah.
And they root against them because of that. So he's pretty unpopular. And then with the younger generation, he's unpopular because they're not successful, and they recognize that he's calling all the shots.
Sure.
And even me watching just as a fan, as an amateur fan growing up, seeing the people who he's chosen to be head coach minus one, seeing the people he's chosen, the route that he's gone, you just look at these guys and you go, really? Like, he wants a yes man.
Exactly.
The one thing, which interestingly enough, the one thing I think he did do right was – he got Parcells for mm-hmm. a few years. And Parcells, being Parcells, comes in. It's like, I'm not going to be your yes man. And he made all these conditions with him and said, this is the way it's going to be. It's going to be my team. I'm going to call the personnel shots and everything. And they did that. And it went pretty well for a couple of years. And then what's interesting, after Parcells built that team up for a few years,
mm-hmm.
well, then he leaves. Okay, but his team that he built with all of his guys, he drafted, he developed, including Romo and Witten and guys like those. Then the very next year, that team goes 13-3. That was Parcells' team.
Exactly.
If Parcells had been the head coach that year instead of Wade Phillips, that team would have won the Super Bowl. They went 13-3 in the regular season.
He built it all.
Yeah,
and then he just left.
And then the coaching was just terrible. And, you know, it was back in Jerry and Wade Phillips'
team. You see that a lot in college where somebody will take over.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's obviously somebody else's team because you have all these kids mm-hmm. that work, you know, you have, you know, juniors and seniors. So it takes a couple of years for it to become apparent. Well, this guy doesn't really know what you know, this guy's kind of, you know. So, at the pro level, I think I guess the turnover is pretty high for coaches at the pro level. But I tend to notice it more in college just because the players cycle through, I think, a lot faster.
Yeah.
And so I think you start to see it where it's like, oh yeah, this guy has no clue what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, he's got all these the freshmen under him are now, you know, juniors and they're starting and they're not very, you know,
right.
Okay, now we see where this, you know, where this is going. But it's too late by that time.
Oh,
he's invested.
Yeah, it's too late.
And he's ruined a
whole he's ruined a cycle.
A whole cycle of Do you get now? How far is Dallas from San Antonio geographically? How far is if you're going to drive? How far is
it? It's like 3.5-4 hours, depending. I-35 is we don't call them the 35. I-35 Interstate 35 is pretty crazy and hectic. So traffic will make a difference there, but it's relatively close. I've never been to a professional football game.
Is that true?
That's true. Now I've been to plenty of college football games all across the country, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Been to Dodger games, been to a lot of Spurs games, never been to a professional football game. I really looking forward to going here.
You need to
see Jerry World.
It's so funny how being from LA and especially in the wake of I told you when I was a kid, I wasn't really into pro football. So my brothers grew up, they'd go to Raiders games, Rams mm-hmm. games. My brothers are huge Rams fans growing up. So by the time I got interested, the teams were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have, I play fantasy football. This is the first year in a few years I haven't played. So that's how I kind of keep in touch with what's going on. with the players and what's going on in the game. But being from LA, it's weird that so many people here like so many teams from other places. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to me when, like, say, I'm a Dodgers fan, so there's no way I'm rooting for any team from San Francisco just because it's like the Giants are there. I hate the Giants. They're my hated enemy. So I can't root for the 49ers because it's the same town.
Right.
There's like a Venn diagram. And if, like, I was telling somebody last year, I said, I don't hate the 49ers, but if they win the Super Bowl, that means that makes at least one Giants fan happy.
Right.
And I can't have that because I'm a total hater. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's weird. That's why I really have been reluctant to kind of, so mm-hmm. I have this running joke on Facebook where whoever the front runner is, like, that week, I'll be like, yes, my fill in the blank. We did it. You know what I mean? We did it. So then I wait till after the Super Bowl and I'll be like, I told you I was rooting for him the whole time. Broncos, it was our year. Like, people said we couldn't do it, you know, or whatever. But it's hard being it's weird being here. And a lot of people kind of throw their lot in with San Diego because San Diego's mm-hmm. so close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's in a 90-minute drive. But it just feels weird to me to kind of go, yeah, that's my team, but it's not, you know,
yeah, it's not,
they're from somewhere else. Like, I can see I lived here or I lived in San Diego and moved here or whatever.
Right.
Or you moved here from Texas and you still rooted for the Cowboys. That's another thing, but it's just weird.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like we have to cover our eyes and then throw a dart at a map and then be like, that's my team.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
The Bengals are now your team. Speaking of which, what's going on with the Bengals? We're 2 weeks into the season.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea what's going on. Nobody, if you would have told me that, what is it? The Bengals are doing well. Who else is doing well? The Browns upset.
The Browns won.
They had beat the Saints without
the Saints are 0-2.
Without Johnny Football. The Saints are 0-2.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. It's a topsy turvy world.
Yeah, it is a topsy turvy world. It'll be interesting to see how things shake out. Your boys down there in San Diego, they actually beat the Seahawks.
They beat the Seahawks? Uh-huh. Anytime Pete Carroll cries, an angel gets his wings. I know I have a lot of USC fans who are listeners, and they hate when I bring that stuff up. But the man's evil. Okay, guys? The man is evil. He's an evil guy. He did everything short of, you know, doing the Nixon wave and then flying off to Seattle, leaving the campus in ruins.
He's smooth.
He's a smooth criminal, man.
He's got his championships, got back in the NFL.
Yep. Everybody loves him. Everybody loves him. You follow USC fans on Twitter, and anything he does, they're all over it. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, this guy, you know, this guy's like it's terrible, man. The mystique escapes me. People go, you're just bitter because you're UCLA. I'm like, not bitter. I just think you don't want to admit you've been had. But that's, you know what? Listen, I've overpaid for a car too. We've all done it. We're going to take a quick break, Brian. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some more. Now that we got to know Brian, we're going to move on to some more important stuff. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back, guys. Okay, guys, we're back from that. That was a huge break. people that aren't on the, have never been on the show, like, they're like, what happens in the break? One of us goes to the bathroom or gets water, and the other one always checks his text, like whoever's in the room. That's generally what happens every time. So we got to know Brian a little bit. And so, Brian, when we first met, you mentioned that you had, you had studied at West Point.
Yes, sir.
Tell us about how you got from football star. I'm going to talk. I'm going to really hype it up. From Texas All-State, all-Texas champion.
More like all-district.
Hey, look at that. Like, humble brag, right? The humble brag. You're all-district. Good for you, man. That's awesome. Let me ask you a question. Are you when you slipped out of the pocket, were you a scrambling guy?
Oh, absolutely.
I had to. Those are some big guys down in Texas, man.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. I'm playing against guys who were signing D1.
Yeah.
D1 contracts and whatnot, different schools around the state.
That's crazy. So. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. And so had you already decided early on that it was West Point something that was in your future that you were working towards?
Yeah, so it was definitely in the back of my parents' mind, and really it was more of a dream, honestly. My dad, you know, he lived a whole life out here in California before him and my mom got together and had moved to San Antonio. And so he had a previous marriage, and he had raised children already, and, you know, some things went well, some things didn't go well. And so when I came around with my mom, they were going to give it their best shot.
Yeah.
And part of that, they thought that somebody in my generation, our generation, could really benefit from discipline.
Sure.
And then obviously the education being something pretty incredible and remarkable, just having that kind of exposure and broadening of your horizons. Mm-hmm. So they thought it would be a great thing, but really it was kind of a dream. And as time went on, as grades and athletics and extracurriculars and all these things started to pile up and it became more and more of a reality, then I applied and I got in pretty early, then it was kind of a dream come true. And
yeah.
So for me, it had always been kind of presented to me as this is something incredible and worth doing. Mm-hmm. And if you ever get the opportunity to do this, you should just take it. And that was the community that we lived in too, because I went to a private school where they had a tradition of sending people to service academies. So I got the opportunity and I didn't blink. I just took it. For me as a 17, 18-year-old kid, what I was thinking was this is the most challenging thing I could do that I could think of, and I want to do that. It was an adventure.
What made you decide to go to West Point as opposed to, you know, Annapolis or the Air Force Academy? Or...
Right. Well, because God is graceful. He blesses his followers, and he saved me from the Naval Academy, from the Air Force Academy. And I actually say that with a lot of conviction in my heart. But funny enough, so the Naval Academy actually recruits people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't call it that, but they pretty much recruit people. They run these things called summer seminars. They have three of them, 600 kids in each. And you can apply to the summer seminar, and they probably, I don't really know, but I imagine they invite people to apply to those too. And you go there, and you stay there for like a week or something, and they really just sell you on the Naval Academy.
Sure.
I mean, you do workouts and stuff, and they bring in the local SEAL team commander to run the workout. And you're like, this guy's a Navy SEAL. He's leading me in a workout right now. I'm getting to know this guy. Like, this is incredible. Like, this is what the Naval Academy is. And you're right there in the Chesapeake in Maryland there, and it's just beautiful. You do go to classes. You meet the coolest professors. They bring in presentations. So they brought in the commander of the SEALs, and he gave a presentation about, hey, this is what it is to be a Navy SEAL. And he brought in a midshipman, a person who goes to Naval Academy, who had already been accepted after he graduated to go try out for the SEALs. And you know, they just sell you on everything. They tell you about all the history. They tell you how they're better than West Point and everything. Just sell you. And it was an incredible experience. So I actually went to that.
Oh, so you did go to that. Okay.
I went to that. And I got done with that, and I was like, I'm going to the Naval Academy. Forget West Point. You know, I want to go to the Naval Academy.
Sure.
And so my parents said, oh, well, let's take a trip up the road, go see West Point. Up the river. Go see West Point there, and, you know, then you can make a decision. Because they were happy with either one. We go up to West Point, and they could care less, like, who you are or whatever. I walked into the admissions office. I was like, well, we'd like to talk to somebody maybe, and the lady like basically almost like threw us out. Luckily, one of the admissions officers walked by and he was very friendly and he sat down, looked at my file and goes, oh, absolutely. But if it hadn't been for that coincidence,
yeah, you would have been in the Navy.
They would just laugh me out of the door. But yeah, no reception. West Point doesn't even really do a summer seminar. They kind of do. They do a quick one, but it's different. And so I walked away from that summer before my senior year of high school thinking, I'm going to the Naval Academy. Because at the end of that summer seminar, they hand you an application as you walk out the door, 3 months ahead of anybody else can even get one.
Yeah.
And they say, fill this out. And if there's no reason for us not to accept you, then we're going to accept you. And so it's just like free ticket right there. So I walked out. I went home, filled that thing out immediately, and I thought I was going to the Naval Academy. Barely filled out my application to West Point. Only did the essays first. You can do it all in pieces. And did the essays and sent those in. And I got a letter of assurance, which is something a lot of people don't even know about. But letter of assurance that says, listen, you have a lot more steps in the application process, but if you want to be here next year, you will be here.
Wow.
That's basically what that letter says. And so at that point, I completely changed my tune. I'm not going to West Point. The academy's better. It's beautiful. They're mean up there, blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as that happened, I was like, no, okay, I'm going to go to West Point.
Yeah, sure.
So I totally changed my tune, and I think it was a great decision.
What is it for someone – okay, so for those of you mm-hmm. who don't know, West Point is – it's I think the full title is the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
That's
is that
correct.
True?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that true? And it is
– perfect.
Now, from what I understand, mm-hmm. Now when you graduate, you're an officer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
As a second lieutenant?
Mm-hmm. So every cadet who graduates, every person who graduates from West Point gets commissioned by the president as a second lieutenant in the United States Army.
In the Army. Now, I've heard that you can actually you can be in Army, but you can transfer to another branch. Is that correct?
It's possible, very unlikely, especially during the time period that I did it. They were actually allowing Naval Academy and Air Force Academy graduates go into the Army during the war, during the middle of the Iraq War, which is when I was there and graduated. But it is possible, but it's pretty rare.
Okay.
I mean, like 99%. So what is the time you're going to be in the Army?
What's your typical? So you're a cadet, is what they call you. Mm-hmm. You're a cadet. You're mm-hmm. You're not a student. You're a cadet.
Right. Yep.
And are there? What are the differentiations? Like, you know, was it freshman cadet, sophomore cadet?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So what was it like your first day at West Point? What was that like?
Oh, my gosh. So the first day.
Walk us through that.
So you show up.
So you leave Texas.
You graduated in May of 2004 for me. And then in June of 2004, end of June, you report to West Point for West Point style basic training, which is very similar to regular Army basic training. It's just West Point style, mm-hmm. I would say. And so you show up, and your first day is called reception day. And the whole thing is designed – I mean, it's probably one of the most efficient places and systems of anything I've ever seen in my life. But in one day, they take – in my class, I think we had about 1,200 or something like mm-hmm. that – take 1,200 of us, just civilian kids off the streets, and – turn us into soldiers who know how to march and are dressed in uniforms that are fitted for us and just parading all in one day and get us worked into the system administratively and academically and just, I mean, incredible amounts of things that we accomplished that one day. But I can remember, you know, just the idea of standing up perfectly straight, perfect posture all day for like 18, 20 hours that I worked muscles in posture that I didn't even know I had. And I thought I was in pretty good shape. I was in pretty good shape.
You had been a high school athlete. Yeah.
And I can just remember, man, I have been standing up in perfect posture all day long. And these muscles in my back are just sore from having perfect posture. And it's just everywhere you go for that first, it's a 6-week long basic training course. Everywhere you go, you're just being yelled at, challenged mentally more than anything is really the difference between that and a lot of other basic trainings. Just being challenged mentally with constant questions, constant harassment, constant challenges being thrown at you, and just creating an environment of living with anxiety and living with fear and living with pressure and stress on mm-hmm. you constantly, having to deal with that and do things. And there were physical challenges, obviously. That was one of the main ways that he did that. But the mental aspect was the biggest thing that is just constant barrage of mental challenges coming in.
Were there any times early on that you kind of regretted, like you thought, oh, my God, I made the wrong
What did I get into? Well, interestingly enough, looking back and, you know, in hindsight, the hardest thing I thought that most people – the hardest part about West Point for a lot of people is that – it just kind of takes all of your idols away because you don't really have anything to hold on to, okay, other than what's there. And so if you really like working out, for instance, then great. You're going to have a great time. If that's your release, if that's the way you deal with stress, if that's what you enjoy doing, then it's a great place for you. If you really like studying every solitary free moment of your life, then great. You're going to have a great time at West Point.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's really not time for you to do anything else. And so, for instance, if you really take a lot of comfort and joy out of your family, which is a great thing, well, sorry, they're not there.
Yeah.
And you really can't even – you don't have time to connect with them as much as you would like or as a normal student would. So really difficult. And you're basically away in some castle in the middle of New York and you're so isolated. So that's one example. If you came from a background of, you know – you really liked your girlfriend or, you know, the party scene or whatever.
None of that.
None of that's there. No time for it. No availability of it. For me, what I relied on, and it wasn't a conscious decision. It was out of necessity, so I don't take any credit for it. I relied on my faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the good thing about faith is that it can go with you anywhere. And so there were some very difficult times, but I leaned into my faith, and my faith really kind of sustained me in terms of my attitude and my sense of peace. And that was something that I didn't even realize was happening, but that's what was happening, and other people were noticing. It was pretty interesting.
I think that's a thing that – because we talk about this on this show a lot. I do talk about my faith a lot where I'm not I've had trouble in the later years as I've gotten older because of social issues, I'm very liberal, but I also still have mm-hmm. I still have my faith that I grew up with. My dad my dad was born again when I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, mm-hmm. and so seeing that change in his life, you can't have that. This is a guy who quit smoking cold turkey, like when I right. started listening to. There was a pastor on the radio by the name of J. Vernon McGee who used to be he was like an old school, like real old mm-hmm. school kind of preacher, but just straight Bible teaching. There was no window dressing, nothing. He was, mm-hmm. and he had a radio show called Through the Bible, mm-hmm. and he just went through the Bible verse by verse by verse.
That's awesome.
My dad started listening to this. You can still, if you look up J. Vernon McGee,
by the way.
Yeah. And so,
sorry, my church doesn't.
Yeah. And so he started, you know, and mm-hmm. so we found a church and, you know, my mom was Catholic. My mom's still Catholic, and so that was the background I grew up with. But this was so different. This, mm-hmm. you know, the everything my dad was doing was so different, and I saw such a change in him. And you know, kids are really sensitive. You know, when something's weird.
Yeah.
And it was a thing where people around him started to notice, and they were like, "Oh, this is never going to work. Are
right.
you're going to church?" It was like one of those
yeah.
things.
Oh,
like with
yeah.
my dad, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, I love my dad. My dad was, I mean, he passed away a few years ago, but he's to this day still my hero. But, you know, my brothers had a very different experience because mm-hmm. my dad, I came later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so
they remember that before.
And they'll remember it. And they'll be like, you don't remember when dad was this way. You don't remember that dad was that way. And then, but then they go, yeah, but he changed, you know,
yeah.
that really did change him.
Yeah.
And so you see that a lot. And so,
yeah.
You know, I talk about a lot about that where, even though I, you know, people are always surprised because I, you know, when they see where I line up on certain issues, they assume I'm not going
right.
to, and then I tell them, oh no, you know, I consider myself a Christian. They're like, wow, that's really strange. Cause those don't always line up.
Right. Right.
But I feel like, you know, I also have that, you still have that and you realize where that faith comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing, like you were saying, like people identified that in you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has, I noticed that a lot where even though I'm not, you know, I may not be as, I don't want to say as, conservative is the wrong word, but I might not worship the way I used to,
mm-hmm.
but those seeds are still there.
Yeah.
And so when things come up and you get like a certain, you get angry
yeah.
in a certain way, or you tend to, if something troublesome comes up in your life and you react to it a certain way, you realize that, hey, this is still there. You know, those seeds were planted a long time
mm-hmm,
ago
mm-hmm.
and you kind of revert back to them. So whenever your yeah. parents were planting those seeds, and
yes,
you
yes.
didn't think about it when you were playing football
right.
or doing all that
oh,
stuff.
Yeah. Great point.
But all of a sudden here you are and it's the only thing you have.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that, that's something I always, when I see people going through trouble, somebody broke it down for me really, really well. They said, you know, everywhere if you look, if you read your Bible and you look, and this is great for anybody, even if you're not a Christian or you don't identify with, this is still a lesson you can take from you from this, is that every big character, we'll say, we'll call them character. Well, everybody in the Bible that has the people that you, even if people aren't Christians, they identify, they know who Moses is. Mm-hmm. They know who Christ is. They know who the Apostle Paul is. Mm. They all spend time in the wilderness, so to speak.
Yes.
They all spend time away.
Oh, you, very you know, interesting point.
Somebody kind of broke that down for me once when I was going through some bad stuff. And they said, you know.
Yeah, Elijah did. They all spent time away in the wilderness.
Daniel in the lion's den is an example of that, you know. Not as much time, but you know, that's definitely some time out in the wilderness. So this could have been like for you, this is your time to really grow that faith that you was there all along, you know.
And that's a really interesting take on that.
And by the way, this is the most people who listen to this podcast all the time are going to be really freaked out that I just dropped that out. Like, whoa, he's been in the closet the whole time. And it's not that; it's just that there's I feel like there's a time and a place for that type of conversation. Uh-huh. Not that I don't want to share, but obviously you're a person who's you know in tune with that. Mm-hmm. And I think if you go back and listen to some of the episodes that I've done about stuff where I've been very liberal about stuff, I get mad about certain things. Mm-hmm. You're going to go, well, that doesn't sound like the same guy. But I think that's part of. Being a mature Christian or a mature anything is that you're gonna have those variations in your character, I think.
Yeah.
But I you know, was that sort of a revelation you went through when you found out when you were having those? Did you realize, well, I didn't realize I had this much faith, or I didn't realize it was?
Yeah. Well, it was definitely a trial moment. I had a few more, obviously, you know, going into the army afterwards and going to war and seeing some real violence and death and stuff like that. But yeah, it was really one of the beginning moments and experiences, like I think a lot of college kids have, whether they go to West Point or to UCLA, where you say, okay, is this really mine, or was this something that was just kind of forced on me? And they just kind of start walking through that. And for me, I started walking through it in this extreme environment. And so I realized, okay, at the end of the day, where I find comfort, and the thing that I'm turning to for direction and for peace and fulfillment and all these sort of things is my faith. And it wasn't some altruistic decision where I can get credit for it. It was out of necessity, but that God worked through that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he grew me, and he taught me more about himself through that experience, and he taught me how to lean on him, which would then serve me well again when I was, you know, out in the army, you know, educated and trained, and now I'm a leader of soldiers, and now these incredibly terrible and horrifying things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow the army asks its leaders to just be strong in that situation. Mm-hmm. And you can have all the therapy and the psychology that you can dream up of, and have the best care, medical care for people, but it's only going to go so far, is my personal experience. And so as those things were happening and I was experiencing them just as close as anybody was experiencing them, and then seeing how they affected people psychologically, and then seeing how it affected me, and then seeing how those people dealt with them, and then seeing how I dealt with them, I was like, wow, there is a difference here. And the difference, again, isn't any credit to me. Some of these guys were 1,000 times tougher than me.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between how they reacted and dealt with me was, I came back to them, the result I came up with was my faith.
I'm gonna ask you an interesting. I'm gonna play devil's advocate, which is
of course,
which is a great name for what I'm about to do. But you know, the argument I have and my problem, you know, where I go into, you know, like we'll just say politics my problem with the church I have right now is I don't like the amount of politics that have kind of seeped into church. And you know, but the opposite, the problem I have with the liberal side of things is there's and this frustrates me, is that there are a lot of liberals out there who openly mock people of faith.
Right.
And so that's where we're having that's where we're butting heads.
Yeah.
And so I get frustrated with people who I align with politically because they can't help themselves from making some kind of joke where I'm just like, do you not understand that, you know, you turn off so many people who want to listen to what you had to say.
Yeah.
And so now I'm going to play the part of one of those people because what I'm thinking right now is the question I want you to answer is, I know so many people who will say, well, you know, religion is just a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
And religion is something that people go to when, you know, people who get caught. Oh, he got caught cheating on his wife, or he got arrested for this, or he got arrested for that. And now he wants to be faithful.
Mm-hmm.
But you were in a situation where you didn't even realize this was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you weren't really, you know, if you told one of your professors that you, it wasn't going to help you. In other words, there was no possible way. So in those dark moments you had when you, or those quiet moments you had when you were alone at West Point, you realized that you have this faith. How would you respond to people who say, well, you know, you're only using your faith as a crutch? And first of all, what's wrong with that?
Right,
all need a crutch, right?
Right.
For some people, it's drinking. For some people, it's drugs. For some people, it's whatever. So how would you respond to people that say, well, you know, you're only using it as a crutch?
Yeah. I think that God is sovereign, that he uses us and our, and just our weakness and, you know, where we're at, he meets us where we're at. So if the extent of my relationship with him was that, you know, I was using him for sustainment, he's going to meet me there and then he's going to grow me from that point, to where eventually he grows me and trains me and I learn more about him to where then he can use me for his purposes and what he cares about and what his heart is at. And that's exactly what he did. And that's exactly where I'm at now, to where I'm not using God anymore. I'm serving God.
Mm-hmm.
But in my service to God, at this organization I'm with now, the 100 People Network at the Austin Stone Community Church in Texas, in my service to him, I'm incredibly blessed. So, yes, there was a very like elementary, just self-interested starting point.
Mm-hmm.
But God took me from that.
Yeah.
And he grew me. And now I'm at the point where I'm serving him and I'm sacrificing worldly things for him, comforts for him, so that I can live for what I believe his purposes are in the world.
And I think it breaks down into what I tell people is, you know, when people want to kind of hate on and it's, you know, it's easy because I think a lot of times there's so much stuff that and the reason that I really kind of cringe at, you know, religion getting mixed up with politics is that so much of it becomes a sideshow.
Yes.
So you get people, you get things like, for example, you get something like the whole Chick-fil-A thing going on and it just turns into the circus.
Yeah.
And at the base of it is a chicken sandwich, for Pete's sake. And it just makes everybody look ridiculous. Yeah. You know, everybody involved looks so ridiculous. And I just always have this, and I think that when you have faith, you start to realize, I think, you kind of get this image that you know that God has a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. You know, you start to realize that and I always just have this image in my head of just Jesus doing like a face palm. Just like, what are you guys doing?
I think you're totally right, Mario. I think you're totally right. And you know, when you talk about all those issues, and I think that's the perfect visual image is, when you talk about a lot of those issues, and I think especially in our culture, in American culture, I think that, and I get a lot of this from a guy named David Platt, who wrote a book called Radical, where he's basically talking about how I don't blame people who in this country are skeptical of religion and faith. And I think a lot of it has to do with is that we've taken the American dream, and again, I borrow a lot of this from this guy named David Platt, but we've taken the American dream and we've put that over the gospel.
Exactly.
As opposed to taking the American way of life and putting the gospel over it and letting the gospel change what that looks like. We've taken the gospel and we've changed it.
We're trying to fit it into what we want to do. Exactly. And that's why you get so many people saying things, or they'll put forth ideals that aren't necessarily Christian, but they'll say, well, because the founding father said this, or they want the founding something the founding father said to fit this very, this very narrow parameter, and it doesn't. And so that's why people, I think, get so caught up in this idea. Yeah. And you're exactly right what you're talking about. What was the name of that book?
It's called Radical by David Platt.
I'm going to check it out.
It's a really interesting book, and he really just tries to challenge a lot of the cultural assumptions that we all have about what faith should look like and say, this is what American faith looks like, but is that what faith of the Bible looks like?
Exactly.
And that goes into, you know, what I'm getting into now with the 100 People Network at the Austin Stone Community Church. We believe that God is about taking his name and glorifying his name and his message of salvation through his son to every last tribe, tongue, and language on the face of this earth, every people group. And if you look at the numbers, it's actually remarkable for a couple of reasons. There's something else called joshuaproject.net, which just anybody who's interested in, you know, academic nerdy things would love to check out. But you'll go to joshuaproject.net, and you can look at all the different people groups in the world. And there's about, I got the numbers right here, but there's about 9,756 people groups in the world. Some of them are, and that's a people group is defined by a tribe, tongue, and language. So if there's some difference there, if these people speak this language, these people speak this language, that's another people group, for instance.
Okay.
So there's about 9,000 of them in the world, make up the 7 billion total people in the world. Out of the 9,000, about 5,000 of them have been reached with the gospel. But that means there's almost 4,000 groups of people left out there that have no idea who Jesus even is. And so those people, okay, they will probably be born, live, and die their whole lives, and they'll never even come in contact with anybody who knows anything about Jesus. It's incredible. There's almost 3 billion people total that will never even hear about Jesus in their lives. Meanwhile, in the United States, for instance, just to compare, you've got statistically almost overwhelming majority, almost all Americans have somebody in their own family who has some sort of faith. So in America, you don't even have to go outside your own family to ask somebody about Jesus, whereas in some of these people groups around the world, they would have to go completely outside of their culture and outside of anything that's really reasonable for them to learn anything about Jesus. So our group, for instance, is, and this goes back to what we're talking about, but our group is dedicated to going to those people groups and bringing the message of the gospel to them. Because we believe, after looking at the scriptures, that that's what God's heart is at. That's what Jesus was saying when he was on, you know, the mountain before he ascended back into heaven. He was saying, go and make disciples of all nations, of all people groups. Ponte te ethne is the Greek. We believe that's where his heart is. So you have, on one end, going back to what we're talking about, you have go and make disciples of all people groups. Okay. And then live the American dream, right? With faith. But they're very different things. You know, you think about all the things associated with the American dream, comfort, success, and things that I grew up in.
Sure.
Things that I've achieved, things that my family is a part of. So I'm not dodging, bashing America or the American dream. My dad grew up in South Central Los Angeles and put himself through the LA County Sheriff's Department and the GI Bill because he went to Korea and all these things. Put himself through JUCO and Redlands and Cerritos, and then he went to graduate school at USC.
Hey, Cerritos.
Yeah, so I mean, my dad is
Don't mention USC on this podcast.
Right.
My
dad is the American dream, and I'm a extension of that. So I'm not bashing America, but what I am saying is that very different what it looks like to follow Jesus when you look at what the Bible says and what Jesus says it looks like to follow him. And then what we've done in this country with our faith.
Yeah.
There's very different things. And so I don't blame a lot of people who are skeptical.
Yeah, it's hard because I think what happens, Brian, is that I think a lot of America is fearful, and I think a lot of America is a lot of what we do is very reactionary. And so when you have, you know, the thing I see, the quote that, or the scripture that always pops into my head all the time is, you know, when they give him, when they give Jesus the coin, and he says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's."
And give God what's God's.
In other words, you know, the governments and everything in the world, they're gonna come and go.
Yeah, they're gonna exist. They have a role.
They have a role.
Yeah,
but that's completely different than what what God wants.
Yes,
and we get into, I think we get into so much trouble because everybody plays that interpretation game where we want to say, "Well, this is what God wants." This is what God wants in America. This is what God. But, you know, like my wife says, you can't go wrong if you go out and you preach love.
That's true.
I mean, that's that's the essence of Christ's message is love.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And so
forgiveness and mercy.
And so I'll ask you and you know, again, devil's advocate. Somebody listening is going to say, well, you know, why, you know, religion seems to cause so much trouble in the world. Mm-hmm. Why do these 4 million people need to hear that? Like, why are you doing that? What would you say to them?
I would say to them that there's another really interesting for academics and just people interested in these sort of things. There's another incredible book out there called Miraculous Movements by Jerry Truesdale. So in this book, the subtitle of the book is How Hundreds of Thousands of Muslims are Falling in Love with Jesus, and it's happening in North and West Africa, in East Africa, excuse me. So incredible, another incredible book. But in that book, my answer is that we are seeing, and it's happening in Africa, in the Middle East even, in Iran, in the stands, all the stands, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, in India, and in China, okay, and in Malaysia, the Philippines, and all these places, we are seeing how when the gospel is brought to these groups of people who have never even heard it before, how it is changing mm-hmm. entire communities, starting with individuals and families and communities and tribes and peoples and languages. I mean, it's just changing people. And there's one story, you can actually look it up on Vimeo, but there's one story of this tribe, and it's a very long story, cut short, but basically this tribe was a very warrior tribe, lots of just continual warfare. Every spring they went to war, and this was in the Philippines, I believe. And a group of missionaries, I think it was like a family, actually one family, went there back in the 50s, had a lot of issues. They almost had to leave because there's just constant warfare. And finally, the gospel took root.
Mm-hmm.
And then they stayed there. They built a church, like a church of people, not a building. And the gospel started to spread within that tribe. Well, then that tribe then started to reach out to the other tribes in the area. Suddenly there was peace because all these tribes now had the gospel. Anyways, the missionary stayed there for, you know, a couple, 10 years or so, and then they left, which is what you're supposed to do. And, you know, at a certain point you become a burden to them because they think they need you to have this message.
Yeah, yeah.
So they left, which you're supposed to do, but then they got to visit a few years ago. And so now this man, who was in, you know, his 20s and 30s when he came, is now in his 70s, and he shows up and he gets off the plane, and the first thing he says is, "Oh my gosh, look at all the old people." Because when he was there initially, life expectancy for that tribe and for all those tribes and all those people was like 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You got disease, you got crime, you got war, you got all these terrible things, you know, poverty, starvation. Life expectancy was like 30 years old.
Yeah.
And then he's stepping off the plane, he goes, "Look at all the gray hair." All these people are living into their 50s and 60s and 70s mm-hmm. now because they've stopped fighting with each other.
Yeah.
There's men, there's old men. That was the biggest thing. There were a few old women before, but mm-hmm. now there's old men. And so just in that very simple way of before the gospel, I would say to the skeptic or the critic, before the gospel, you have all these terrible things which led to life expectancy being like this long.
Mm-hmm.
And post-gospel, you have old people.
Yeah.
And that's just one way. And I could go on and on and on in that story, but that's just one way. And so we're seeing that, and especially in that book, Miraculous Movements, we're seeing that happen all over the world. We're seeing real change. And there's no doubt that there will be trouble ahead for communities who accept the gospel, just like, you know, our culture accepted Christianity hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we still live in a fallen world, and there's still problems and issues that come
sure.
up, and Satan is active. And so now he distracts us with comfort and with success and all these things. He doesn't use disease and
yeah.
polio and stuff like that anymore because we're kind of past that. So he's coming at us from a different angle. And so these cultures, they will face similar challenges down the road. But much like our own cultures hundreds of years ago when we first accepted the gospel, there is dramatic change. And I'm a little bit of, you know, I get a little bit out there in the sense that I think there is a direct correlation between our lives and how good they are and the amount of gospel that's a part of our culture and our society, whether we realize it or not. And the people who are smart enough to say, look at the founding fathers. The founding fathers, okay, were writing this incredible document, really kind of the first of its kind, a radical experiment. But at the same time, you know, before they went over to Constitution Hall, they're having a prayer meeting at the church down the road. And they were, if you read a lot of their documents, their personal documents, the really the the other element that would make it work in their minds was our Judeo-Christian background and values. And they said, if that's a part of our culture, then that will fill in the gaps of the system that we're setting up. And so I think there is a correlation between good things in the gospel, and we're seeing it happen all around the world, Mario.
I think what people – I think the problem people have is because they want to look at the modern American Christianity that you and I have talked about.
Exactly, and I don't blame them for
and
being
they think
skeptical
that that's
that.
What – but yeah. But if you've ever done any kind – and you know, my the extent of my missionary work is going to like – an orphanage, you know, outside of TJ or, you know, outside of Mexicali.
That's not awesome.
Nowhere far, nowhere far. You know what I mean? But that's the extent of my, but when you realize what, that missionary work is so much more than just, I think what people, what people have in their minds is just going out, someone just going out and, you know, teaching, you know, preaching fire and brimstone. And it's so much more than that. And when you look at, here's a great example. Look at the guys, the Americans that contracted Ebola. They were working for Samaritan's Purse, which is a Christian organization.
Yeah.
They go into third world countries, they offer medical, you know, medical services. That's missionary work. Some people, you know, it's not just going somewhere and like
that's
we're going to set up a tent and
real.
These guys are bringing they're building they're building infrastructure. They're building they're helping people, you know, bring clean water. They're doing all kinds of things.
Oh yeah, that, and taking risks
and you know, the guys that you know, look what happened to the doctors with that contracted Ebola. They're back here now, thankfully.
Yeah,
but
I know a few people in this in that organization.
There's so much more to when Brian says, you know, they're going to go out and I want you to take a quick break, but I want you to break down exactly what you're going to be doing in this new organization. But I think that's the one thing people, they want to jump on it and go, well, look at you, you're trying to, and they think it's kind of like the Crusades where you're going out there with a sword and going, listen, you know, convert or else. Yeah, there's so much more, there's so much real work that's being done. And I think it's one of those things where, and you touched on this a little bit, I think that once people start working and doing that kind of work, you get blessed in a way that you necessarily wouldn't in other ways.
So
you were just sitting at home, sending money, which is good too, which is good too, you know, you're going home. Or
very necessary.
It's also necessary, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of, you helping others.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't even have to be going into, you know what, guys, just be nice to one another for a whole day and just try to do. Be unselfish for a whole day and you'll see how it affects you.
Yeah.
It has a real positive effect. But we're going to take a quick break and then Brian is going to go more into his organization and their work. And we'll be right back. Right, we are back with segment three with Brian. Brian, this has been really great so far, and you shared a lot about your faith and about your mission, and you have something really exciting. And so you have a nonprofit you're working for, and you've mentioned it a couple of times. But why don't you just straight from the top, just break it down and let us know the name of the organization and what it's all about?
I would love to, Mario. Thank you. So I'm working for the 100 People Network at the Austin Stone Community Church in Texas now. The 100 People Network is a nonprofit. It's really the missions arm of the Austin Stone Community Church. But they decided to make it its own separate entity and make it a network. And the vision of the 100 People Network is that we wanted to send 100 people, it's in the name, wanted to send 100 people to those 4,000 unreached peoples. As many as we could with 100 people, and that was our starting goal. Pretty ambitious, because the reason why there's 4,000 groups of people, totaling almost 3 billion people left in the world, the reason why there's 4,000 groups of people left, there's a lot of reasons, but some of them are, they're in pretty difficult environments. They're in countries that are, it's illegal to talk about Jesus, for instance, like China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, places like that. And they're in places that are either politically hostile to the gospel, or culturally or economically or historically hostile to the gospel. So that's why there's so many people left, and there's geographical barriers, there's all sorts of reasons. But we believe that the gospel can change those communities and can just bring about real lasting impact. And so we wanted to send people specifically to those groups of people.
So that's 40 groups each. You know that, right?
Right, right, right. So we would say, you know, we would send 100 people out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We might hit 100 groups. But we wanted to send 100 people to some segment of those 4,000 people mm-hmm. groups. So we went on that. It was a very difficult journey. I mean, you're talking about things that in 2,000 years the church hasn't been able to do. We're trying to do now.
Yeah.
And so it was very difficult. We actually, somewhere along in the process, a couple of years in, we brought in this other organization called Launch Global. Okay, and Launch Global, what they do is they help churches professionalize their missionary processes and training programs and regimens and development programs. So we brought in Launch Global, partnered with them, and then together we built this system of training people and recruiting people and, you know, and then sending them and preparing them and then sending them overseas. And so what's crazy is that we've actually hit that goal.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually at 101 people now.
Wow. So you got an extra, you got a bonus guy.
Right. And so now we're thinking about, well, hey, man, I mean, we got to change the name now. We got to think bigger.
People. Sure.
We got to go, man, we've asked God to be faithful with this and he's done it. And in the scriptures in Ephesians 3:20, it talks about how God can do far more than we can ever think or dream or ask of him. And so now we're asking, we're in the season of, okay, God, we've asked you to do this. And we thought this was huge. And it was huge, and you did it. Now what does it look like for us to do far more than that,
sure.
far more than we could ever even think or ask or dream? And so now we're thinking about what that looks like. You know, are we the 1,000-people network? Are we the 100 groups of people network? I mean, so that's where we're at now. And funny enough, too, and that's all been in 5 years. This basically started in 2009. So in 5 years, we've become one of the largest, if not the largest, local church missionary sending body in the country, and then one of the largest in the world. So that's all been incredible. But what's also interesting, Mario, is that we're having this success, you know, with Launch Global's partnership and just raising up people within our own body. And these things are happening. We're developing these systems. Our training program for goers is, at a minimum, it's about 2 years long, stateside. And then really it takes most people 3 years to complete.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask them to commit to 2 years overseas at a minimum. Depending on the language, if it's a very difficult language, we'll ask them to commit to a minimum of 3 years overseas, with that first year being language alone, language training alone, before they ever even go into where their final destination is and share the gospel. So pretty extensive program,
mm-hmm.
Pretty extensive process. But it's successful, and it's happening. And so other churches in Texas and around the South are now looking at what's happening, seeing the fruit, to put it in biblical terms, seeing the fruit that we're bearing, and they're saying, show us how to do this. And so now our church and 100 People Network and Launch Global are now reaching out to these other churches and helping them stand up these things on their own. And so again, for people who are interested in these kind of things and, you know, just – anything nerdy in general, really. Okay, you think about, there's 4,000 groups left. Well, if we keep going, okay, us alone, we'll have 400 people in the field
sure.
in 5 years, just us. And then we have another church in Lubbock, Texas, called Experience Life. Another church in Houston, or two churches, one in College Station, one in Houston. I believe they're both named Grace Church. And if they start to do what we're doing, they're also around, you know, in areas with a lot of young people, very mobile people. That 4,000, and think about the hundreds of people that might come from their churches in the next few years, that 4,000 groups of people, that number, doesn't become so unrealistic anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's where we're at right now, is we're looking and we're going, man, if we keep going where we're going, we're going to reach those 4,000 groups of people. And it's not like we're the only people doing this. There are a lot of people doing this. And what's even more interesting is that what they call the majority South, okay, the new church, basically, you know, you've got new Christians in China sending missionaries out.
Yeah.
And you got new Christians in India and the Philippines and in Africa sending Christians out. And so you put all that together, those 3 billion people that are left, some people are projecting, and JoshuaProject.net is a part of this, but some people are projecting that those people groups are going to get reached in our lifetime. And there's you can take that in a lot of different ways. And from the biblical perspective of, the Bible says some things are going to happen once the whole world hears about
Jesus.
And so you can start to like, wow. And I mean, that's a little bit of a projection and an estimation. And it's hard to predict the future, of course, and nobody can. But one thing that is true, okay, a hard fact, is that we are the first generation of Christendom, okay, first generation of the Christian faith, of followers of Jesus that have had enough knowledge and enough technology and education to even understand what it means when Jesus said all the people groups. We can look at a map and look at human geography and all those things because of all the resources available to us and go, okay, how many people groups are there really? And we can generally, we don't know exactly how God counts all those things, but we can kind of see, okay, there are this many people in the world.
Yeah.
And there are this many people groups.
These many languages.
And we're the first generation that that's ever been even possible. So even that is exciting. Just
thanks,
to know.
Google.
Yeah, exactly. That even that's just exciting to know. Man, we've never even been able to understand the problem before. Now we can.
Let me ask you a question. Like you talked about going into places where, you know, very hostile to Christian to Christianity. How do you go and set up a church in a place? Like who is the pathfinder there? Do you send? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So what's really neat is that it is difficult and it does take a lot of time. And really you have to approach it from a biblical perspective. So in and we train our goers in this. We actually practice these things, these skills, in Austin, Texas. So there's a community in Austin where there's a lot of internationals. There's a lot of international students. There's a lot of international refugees and just immigrants of one sort or another from all over the world. They congregate in this one area of Austin. And so our goers, our missionaries, actually move at some point in their process. They move into that neighborhood. We're talking about what it is to like really follow what Jesus said biblically, like go and tell as opposed to come and listen.
Yeah.
And I borrowed that from a guy named Francis Chan. But that's kind of like going and telling, right? We're going to those people, right? Their community where they live in Austin. We're living amongst them, making friends with them, and then we're practicing these principles. So really where we get a lot of that from is Mark chapter 4. Okay, and there's a parable of the sower. And Jesus basically talks about how there's four different types of soil, okay? There's soil that's thrown on the rocky path. There's soil that – let me just pull it up real quick.
It's hard ground.
Right. And he says, listen, behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell on the path. So that's the path. And the birds came and devoured
it.
That's the first one. Okay, other seed fell on rocky ground, which you mentioned, Mario, where it did not have much soil. And immediately it sprang up. So you have the birds is the first one. The rocky path is the second one.
Now it's too shallow for roots to take hold.
Yep. And since it had no depth of soil, and when the sun rose, it was scorched. And since it had no root, it withered away.
See, I know what I'm talking about, guys.
There you go.
Sometimes.
And then the third type, other seed fell among thorns. This is the interesting part, okay? Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. Interesting. So, and then the fourth type of soil, and other seeds fell into good soil, and it produced grain, growing up, increasing, and yielding 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. Okay, so basically, okay, I mean, this is you could write a book about this, and people have, but you know, it's scripture. It's a parable from Jesus. It's as deep as anything on this earth. But there's four types of soil. And Jesus is saying that the sower is the person who believes. And they just go out and they sow the seed. And
spreading the gospel.
You're spreading the gospel. And so this is generally the answer to your question. You go out and you sow, and God, eventually, God will have brought good soil to you. Eventually, you're going to sow seed on good soil, and you won't even know it. You can go, Jesus goes on to explain it later. It's going to sprout and it's going to grow. And then you're going to wake up like a farmer one morning and go, oh my gosh, there's a plant or there's a tree, there's fruit. But you, a lot of times you won't even know. And so really you just go and you sow. Now, the way that you sow looks different for every cultural context that you're in. First thing you got to do is you got to know the language. Second thing you got to do is make friends. And before even that, you got to have a reason to being there and a reason to be accepted in the community. And so, again, that looks different all the time, whether it be medical missions. There's a lot of really cool stories about that. or, you know, building wells or community development, agricultural
development. Again, what we talked about.
Yeah, like real things that you can give where you're doing something and showing them and living out your faith and then simultaneously sowing the word.
Yeah.
And so what eventually happens, though, is that as we sow, as we do things for people, and as we sow, we fall on some good soil, and then disciples are made, and they make more disciples, and before you know it, you have a church. And that church, we train them to, again, instead of just, okay, now you've heard, and now you're good, don't just sit here and listen and consume, but now it's time for you to go and tell yourself.
And we talked about it in the break.
Yeah, exactly.
The fat sheep.
Yeah, exactly. So that's generally, that's a biblical answer to your question. Again, we're sending people all around the world to all these different contexts, and every situation looks different.
Yeah.
What works in terms of getting us into the country and the community accepting us and wanting us to be there, what works in Africa, in Sudan, may not work in Malaysia. And so we have to – every one of those situations is different. But at the end of the day, once we do penetrate into the community, find a way to stay there and where they want us there, then it is about sowing naturally through friendships and relationships. And then that's how those things happen.
And I think, you know, I think this goes back with what something that I heard a long time ago, but, you know, people say that when you let people know that you're a Christian, that you know, you're the only Bible some people might read.
Mm, yeah.
And, but, you know, and then it's like, you know, these actions speak,
yeah.
You know, like you talked about the, you know, you told a story, during the break, about some missionary
who
went into an area that was, it populated with people who had contracted HIV.
Right.
And their chances of contracting HIV were very high. And some of them did in fact contract HIV.
Exactly.
And they said, this is the price we have to pay. Then it was well worth it.
Yeah.
And, it's hard for somebody to not see that.
Yeah. And to not see, wow.
And not say, wow.
Sacrifice their health for us to get us this message.
And I always tell people this, you know, the bottom line, whether you, you know, whether you think the Bible's a fable or whether you mm-hmm. hold the Bible to be true,
mm-hmm.
If you live your life, if you think of Jesus as just another philosopher, let's just say you have no faith whatsoever. But if you think of Jesus as just another philosopher or somebody or a really cool guy that you know said all this cool stuff, if you live your life by his teachings, if you do what he asks of his disciples, you will touch so many people in such a positive way. And here you're taking it to an example where, you know, this is your faith. So obviously you're taking it that step further because now you're making it a whole, you're making these people, the people that are joining your project, are obviously they're committing minimum 2 years of their lives to this project. So these are people who have this faith and that are believing.
Yeah.
But the bottom line, and this is what I want to stress to people who might be listening, who are non-believers, and, you know, listen to what Brian's saying. These are people that are going in and doing things that no one else will do in these areas.
Yeah.
And dig wells.
Yeah. And that story again is found in that book Radical by David Platt. I mean, they said, we want to go set up a hospital in this region in Africa. And they said, well, why do you want to go there? Well, because nobody goes there. And they're like, well, why does nobody go there? Well, because everybody has HIV, and it's so dangerous, even just for the medical professionals, even with all the precautions you can take, it's so dangerous to go there because somebody from your staff will get HIV. And they said, we want to go anyways. And so they sent to their staff, to their volunteers, doctors and nurses and therapists and everybody from back here in the States, they said to their volunteers, hey, this is where we want to go, and this is the risk. And we will not judge you. We will not be upset with you if you decide that you can't do that. But they all went anyways. And then when they got there, and he tells the story much better than I ever could in the book, but when they got there, immediately, like within the first week, somebody from their staff contracted HIV, one of their volunteers. This is somebody who has a job as a doctor or a nurse or whatever back in the States, who has a job, who has a family probably, who has a whole life back in the United States. They took the risk, knowing the risk, and then it happened. Somebody got HIV. And then the next day, really, really closely after, I forget the timeline, But really soon after, two other people from their staff, their volunteers, contracted HIV. And their response was, hey, if this was the price, like you mentioned, if this was the price, it was well worth it. My life, and this, these people living out their faith in a real way, my life is not more valuable than this group of people hearing about Jesus. Them hearing about Jesus is far more valuable than my life, and I'm willing to risk that. Well, the people, and so they completed the mission. They were there for like a month or so. They left, and it was a temporary like medical mission just to help them, and they left, but the people's response was, nobody ever comes to us.
Yeah.
Everybody's scared of us because they don't want to get HIV, but you came to us, took the risk, knowing the risk. You did that, and you did that in the name of your God. Well, we want to know about that God. And so then a church was planted. And so people came to faith, and then they grew them in their faith and discipled them, trained them, raised them up, and then their church, and they, you know, converted their whole community. So there's another example of like what we've been talking about, which is it does take sacrifice and it does take suffering, but when you do go and tell in the name of Jesus and bring with you real examples of your faith and living it out, it does make a difference.
And you know, that's the difference that when in the break we talked about, I talked about the difference between religion and faith, and and the problem with our country now, I think, is we have too much religion, not enough faith. And I think what you're going out there and doing, this is that to me is what Christianity is. That to me is the true essence of taking Christ's teaching and applying it. And again, it doesn't have to be, you know, if you don't feel like you're called to be a missionary, you know, but you can apply this in your everyday life. And instead of what I love about this project is instead of being divisive, like so much religion can be, you're taking the essence of the gospel. You're going out into the world, and you're bringing hope and you're bringing faith to people that could desperately need it.
And real change. And I mean, we're not, and that's what Jesus did. I mean, exactly, that's how he lived. You know, we're not Jesus, right? We're not walking along the road and healing people, but we have skills. Everybody has skills and talents. And especially in this country, education and knowledge of how to do things, whether it be agricultural or medicine or business, microeconomic development. So all these things, we have things, actual real things to offer these people who have no knowledge of the gospel and who most of them are living. Again, interesting. There is a correlation, I believe, between lack of the gospel and incredible poverty and disease and violence and prevalence of the gospel and the peace and prosperity that we enjoy here in the West, for instance. And so we have real things to offer these people. And then when you offer it in conjunction with the message of the gospel, it's incredibly powerful. And that's exactly what Jesus did. He would go, somebody would say, hey, teacher, rabbi, savior, messiah, heal me. And he would say, do you believe that this can happen? Do you have faith? Do you believe in me? Is what he was asking them. They said, yes, I believe. He said, your faith has healed you. Boom. So he did two things there. He actually healed the person. So real change, but he brought it back to the message of, this isn't just about you and getting healed or some supernatural thing. This is about the message of God empowering me, because God sent me and I'm his son, empowering me to heal you right here. And so that's exactly what he did. And I think we were talking during the break, Mario, about why don't we see these things happening here in America? And you actually brought up how, if you look at the scriptures, when you've been looking at the scriptures, you've been thinking about it and where you're at right now, that prayer was so prevalent and such a foundation for the things that were happening.
I think people go to Twitter now instead of praying, is what it is.
Right.
They want to throw it out there. And instead of, you know, the like my old pastor used to say, you need to be a prayer warrior. So much of that
is the absolute right phrase.
But look how much, and again, going back to, you know, what we talked about earlier, spending your time in the wilderness, how much time, you know, before everything happens, every major, you know, what are your, the biblical heroes doing? They're all praying. Jesus in the garden.
Yeah.
You know, before every momentous occasion. They never just like, well, I'm going to go out and do this. Yeah. I'm going to go out and,
And I think that's the hard thing for us culturally as Americans is that we are. I mean, I've seen it myself firsthand. We are successful. We are powerful. I come from a successful family. I went to this school where the bar for a West Point graduate is go win a World War, buddy, and then we'll put a statue up for you. Like, you know, you walk outside and it's like, oh, well, there's Eisenhower, there's MacArthur. You know, Lee don't even get a statue. Like, no. I mean, like, oh, my goodness.
He went the wrong side.
Right. That's the standard, right? So I've seen power. I've seen how successful this country with our resources and our people really is where our strength is. I've seen the strength of the American soldier and how critical just the type of soldiers, the quality of soldiers that we have, how that allows us to be successful on the battlefield. So I think for us, the problem is that – not the problem, but one of the challenges that we have is that we are successful, that we have kind of created a paradise for ourselves here.
It's hard to leave.
And Southern California is most of the time – not right now, right today, but most of the time that's a great example of like – we have a little bit of a paradise here on earth. And so we want to go back to that and rely on that and what got us here to this point and think that we can get lasting peace and salvation and comfort and just fulfillment out of that. But I think what's happening, especially in my generation, we're seeing that, yes, we have all this prosperity and all this power and security, but that's not enough.
No.
Yeah. And we're like, wow, we have everything that our grandfathers dreamed of us having, but yet I don't feel satisfied. Do you? You know, we're looking at each other and going, man, there must be something more. And then I think, and particularly my generation, you know, we are turning more to spiritual things. We're looking to those things for the answers. And I think that, you know, obviously I'm pretty biased, but I think the answer for those things is Jesus and his message. And, you know, when people really start to follow what he asked people to do and what the Bible records, then I think people really do see change in their own lives and in the people they're going and telling. And again, we're seeing that all over the world. And so it's really exciting.
Brian, where can we find out more about your organization?
Yeah, so absolutely. So the church itself is called the Austin Stone Community Church, and you can just go to austinstone.org. But the network itself is the 100 People Network, and we have our own website, so 100peoplenetwork.org. What's interesting about us is that particularly the people who work for the 100 People Network, who support all the people going through the training and everything like that, we all raise our own support. We do not get paid a salary. And so there's a number of reasons that we do that, but one of them is that it makes us very mobile. So, for instance, with these other churches in Texas who are reaching out to us and say, hey, come show us how. Well, we go, all right, we can, because we're mobile and we're free and we're supported by people donating money to us as individuals. And so we can. We can pick up and go and help these churches and set these things up. But then we also don't charge them anything. It's all free.
Yeah.
And so the way that it's all free, which is we believe that's a biblical concept of offering things for free, right? So
just like the book of Acts.
Right, exactly. So the way that we do that is we raise support. And so if anybody is interested in supporting our organization or supporting me individually, that is something that we're more than welcome to. They can contact, you know, me at my email is brian.rodriguez@austinstone.org. So that's another way they can do that.
Excellent, man. This is a great episode. And like I said, we had very little contact before, but you came out and you outed me. But like I always tell my listeners, it can't always be hobbits and lightsabers, guys.
Yeah.
Sometimes we got to talk about serious stuff. And, you know, again, my faith doesn't cross over. I explained this to you in the break. And I think just because I don't want to – and it's not because I'm ashamed or anything like that. It's just I feel like this probably isn't the best fit. Like a podcast where we talk about zombies and superheroes.
Yeah.
isn't necessarily the best fit for something like that. But that's also kind of why it worked out. I usually have a co-host here with me, and it worked out that, you know, she just happened to have something else going today. But it was nice to have this conversation because as much as – and if people only know me from Facebook where my stuff can get very political. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't talk about that kind of stuff because, you know what, honestly, it's to save myself a headache from both sides, sadly.
Sure.
From
sure.
both sides, sadly.
I understand, yeah.
And I'll give you a good example of what I'm talking about. How you talked about how we're so comfortable. I have a friend who I think is just, she's a pillar of faith. Just, mm-hmm. I think she's fantastic, you know. Lives a really good life, you know, and just a good example. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could pick somebody that my daughter would grow up to be like, it'd be this person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she listens, and I hope she doesn't, because I'm about to tell a story that doesn't paint her in a flattering light. The day they brought the doctor home from mm-hmm. to Atlanta, or where did they bring from? It was Atlanta that had the Ebola.
Yeah.
She was one of the first people saying, why is this happening? Why are they bringing him here? They're going to spread the disease. And I was just thinking to myself, that is the least Christian. That is the least Christian thing I've ever heard her say. And it really, it kind of bummed me out, you know, because I was really, and then it just turned into this whole, the whole thing just turned into this anti-Obama rant.
Mm.
And I was saying, I thought to myself, if someone who knows she's a Christian is friends with her, on Facebook reads that, and they're maybe thinking, wow, I really respect her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't believe,
mm-hmm.
but I really respect what she's saying. Mm-hmm. And they were to see this,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was such a poor example of what mm-hmm. and you know, again, people were reacting out of fear, or maybe it was like a moment of where she just, you know, you get caught up because media has a tendency to blow everything out of proportion, mm-hmm. you know? And, the reason that disease spreads so quickly is because they have no way to dispose of the bodies, or these people are coming mm-hmm. in contact with the bodies,
and, mm-hmm.
and the infection doesn't spread until the person dies.
Right.
And so, you know, they don't have the sanitation that we do and things, the body disposal and things like that. So people are getting the disease is spreading. But with a little bit of information, you would know that and be like, okay, you know, we don't have that problem in the United States. There's a reason the bubonic plague doesn't spread in the United States.
Yeah, if anybody control it, we could.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it really kind of bummed me out
mm-hmm.
that like that was on this person's page. And mm-hmm. that is a reason why I kind of keep the lamp under the basket, so to speak,
yeah.
at least on here,
uh-huh.
because I don't want someone who, I don't want to paint,
yeah.
oh, well, you know, this guy's a Christian, he, you know, he's cool with zombies, so not every, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, I understand.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I'm really glad that I had this a conversation, just because I it's someone going out, and, you know, it's like they say, you know, where the rubber meets the road,
mm-hmm.
and someone out and doing
yes.
work,
yes.
and, you know, just as, and again, you know, being liberal, people tend to take this the wrong way, but any veteran, you know, my dad was a Korean War vet. You mentioned mm-hmm. your dad was a Korean War vet.
Yeah.
My dad was in the Army. His brother was a paratrooper in World War II. So liberal politics aside, I have the utmost respect for anybody mm-hmm. who sacrifices their time and for the freedoms that I enjoy,
yeah.
freedom to do this podcast and freedom
I've enjoyed them too. So, yeah.
But again, you know, and I think, you know, most of my listeners would agree, you know, we thank you for your service
mm-hmm.
and, you know, best of luck and, you know, we'll be praying for your. I will definitely be praying for you and your project to get off the ground. And you know, knowing what I know about missionary work, you know, my limited experience, but knowing I know other people who've gone on mm-hmm. to that type of work and
mm-hmm.
Organizations like Samaritan's Purse and things like that. It's great, but at the same time, it's just so
mm-hmm.
I know that I wasn't called to do it.
Yeah.
So, but
well, you can be a sender or a mobilizer there.
Yeah, I will definitely check it out. But my hat's off to you, and thank you so much for coming in and sharing.
Well, thank you for having me. Absolutely.
Of course. Did you want to add anything before we go? Did you have any other?
No, I'll just say thank you, and I applaud you for being open. You know, like we were talking about, I don't know if it was during a break or not, but. You know, being accepting of people who don't believe is part of who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of our constitution, our values. But you mentioned it should go both ways. So if we're willing to listen to people who don't have faith or who don't believe in things, and we should be able, as Americans, if that's what we believe in, we should be able to listen to those who do.
Yeah.
And so I think you're displaying that. And I applaud you for that, and I applaud your listeners as well. If they have that mentality as well.
Yeah. You don't have to, like I tell people, you don't have to believe. Just respect mm-hmm. what the other person says.
Sure.
Just because if we get into it with somebody, mm-hmm. I want them to respect where I'm coming from. Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not gonna go out and just start dissing them right away.
Yeah.
Unless they're Giants fans, that's a whole different
well,
ball of.
I'm with you on that one. As a Cowboys fan, I'm with you on that one.
I was talking San Francisco, but you have no love for the New York Giants either. Brian, thank you so much. And who's your Super Bowl prediction? I need to know.
Oh, Super Bowl prediction? That's a rough one right there.
You're the best athlete we've had in this chair ever.
Man, I think you're really not going to like this, but I think Carroll might get it done again up there.
You think so? You know what? Here's the thing. I do not dislike the Seahawks.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Just Pete Carroll. Like, you know, the Seahawks are one of those teams that, like, they're like the Chargers. Uh-huh. They always hang around and nothing ever good seems to happen for them. They get close, and then so this year, and I'm a huge Derek Coleman supporter. I he went to UCLA, and he's deaf. Great story there.
Right.
So I'm all for that guy. So it's just but Pete Carroll, man.
He's a snake, but
he's not a nice guy. He just looks like someone who would sell you like the worst timeshare.
Oh,
just like the worst. Like just
poor Pete.
That's okay. He's not listening. Pete's okay.
Yeah, Pete's doing all right. Pete's doing. All right. Oh, we got a contract extension last year.
Exactly. You know what? I mean, if it gets to be too much, you can stub a national championship in one ear and a Super Bowl trophy in the other. He's not going to hear a word I'm saying, so it doesn't matter.
That's true.
Well, Brian, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Again, anytime you please, I'll keep in contact with you.
Okay.
And if you want to give us an update on, on what's going on or anything like that,
I would love to,
just keep in touch. Definitely. And I'm really glad we got to meet and, everything happens for a reason, man.
Yes,
everything happens for a reason.
It does. There's
some
no
people, karma, some people call it kismet. Some people call
providence.
It fate.
Providence.
We would say it's providence, but, good to meet you. And again, best of luck to you. So for Victoria, for everybody here at Undercity Chaos, for Brian Rodriguez, as I, every show, I will say that this transmission ends now.